Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 10th of August. This hour of the program, we talk about federal judge Vaughn Walker's opinion last Wednesday in favor of same-sex marriage. In his ruling, he said California's voter-approved ban on same-sex marriage irrationally discriminates against gay men and lesbians. The judge stayed his own decision and agreed to consider a longer stay that could last until a ruling on appeals by proponents of Proposition 8. Our guest this hour, a professor at Northwestern Law School, Andrew Koppelman, says if the Supreme Court does not want to uphold same-sex marriage, its job has been made harder by this decision. He'll tell us the reasons for that coming up this hour of the program. Our number two of our show this Tuesday, Dr. Connie Mariano, who's written a fascinating book about her years as the White House doctor. She was President Bill Clinton's personal physician, and she was head of the White House medical unit under George Herbert Walker Bush, and also worked with the last Bush presidency. It's a fascinating story about treating presidents and first ladies and heads of state and the drills that are gone through to anticipate really the worst. She will be with us to talk about her stories. She is the first naval woman to be a presidential physician and the first Filipino. So she will be with us hour two. Both hours, you're welcome to join our conversation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655 and our email address, talk@wpr.org. Professor Andrew Koppelman is John Paul Stevens Professor of Law and Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University. He is the author of Same-Sex, Different States, When Same-Sex Marriages Cross State Lines. He's also author of Forced Labor, a 13th Amendment Defense of Abortion, Does Obscenity Cause Moral Harm, The Fluidity of Neutrality, and many other books, and of course, has written extensively in a number of publications. Professor Koppelman, thank you so much for being with us.
Very happy to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So what do you mean when you said that if the Supreme Court doesn't want to uphold same-sex marriage, its job has been made harder by this decision?
So you have to understand there are three levels of federal courts. There are the federal district courts, the courts of appeals, and the Supreme Court. And they divide up labor between them. So at the trial level, the trial court doesn't get the last word on what the law is, and cases get appealed because the people who are appealing claim that the trial court made a mistake about the law. But the trial courts get to find the facts. They just ordinary rule that when district courts hear facts, they see witnesses, they assess the credibility of witnesses, they go through the record. The higher courts, the courts of appeals, are supposed to defer to the trial court's findings of fact.
Mm-hmm.
And what the district judge did here was he made a lot of findings of fact that are going to be very hard on any view of the law to say that the state has a legitimate interest in barring same-sex marriage. So here are some of the factual findings of matters of fact that the judge made in his decision. He found, based on, and he cited witnesses that testified to this and that weren't effectively contradicted, that same-sex marriage is good for gay people, it's good for the children that they raise, that one out of five same-sex couples in California are raising children, that there are no discernible differences between same-sex and opposite-sex couples in terms of any measure of quality of relationship, that domestic partnerships don't offer the same benefits as marriage, and that they stigmatize same-sex relationships as inferior. He found that recognition of same-sex couples' right to marry doesn't do any detectable harm to heterosexual marriages. And he found that the campaign for Proposition 8, well, that is the proposition that outlawed same-sex marriage in California, relied on prejudice and anti-gay stereotypes like the idea that gay people are dangerous to children, which have no foundations in fact.
Mm-hmm.
So the Supreme Court on appeal, or the Court of Appeals on appeal, if it's going to say there's no right to same-sex marriage, is going to have to say why there's no such right, even though all these facts are true. And it's going to be hard to write that opinion.
Tell me a little bit more about the trial. Who were the witnesses?
So there were a number of expert witnesses who know about the history of marriage, who have studied same-sex couples. There were several psychologists who have basically spent their careers studying same-sex couples and how they actually function. There are a number of historians who are expert in the history of marriage. And so there were people who had closely studied the Proposition 8 campaign. And so there were a number of people who testified to, basically the factual predicate for all the findings that I just described.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very peculiar thing about the trial. The defenders of Proposition 8 had a number of witnesses that they listed that they were going to introduce. And then when it came round to the trial, most of those witnesses declined to testify. And we really haven't yet gotten a good explanation of why that's so, why the defenders of Proposition 8 were so incompetent at managing their own witness list.
Huh. Why do you think?
I don't dare speculate. until they tell the story,
right.
And it's not a story they're eager to tell because it doesn't reflect very well on them. If you're a lawyer and you're going to trial and you collect, they could have collected anybody among their list of experts. Basic skill, you should be able to collect witnesses who are actually going to show up at the trial. And there really wasn't any explanation for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's also going to make it harder for a court on appeal to reverse them because, the deference to findings of fact is not absolute. The court on appeal can go back, look at the record, and say that the trial court was clearly erroneous, clearly mistaken, based on the Court of Appeal's own reading of the facts. But the defenders of Proposition 8 really didn't give the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court anything to hang that conclusion on because they introduced hardly anything.
The defenders did say that they were abiding by the will of California voters. What does that mean in this trial? Isn't that significant?
Well, not really, because any time you make a constitutional challenge to a law, the law that you're challenging presumptively either was enacted by the voters or by the elected representatives of the voters. Having a constitution at all is counter-majoritarian. Whenever you've got a constitution that does any work at all, it prevents majorities from getting what they want. So it's assumed whenever you raise a constitutional challenge that you are going to be overriding the will of the majority if the constitutional challenge prevails. In Brown versus Board of Education, the majority of voters in Kansas elected a legislature that decided to have segregated schools. So the fact that a majority wants it has no weight at all in constitutional law. The courts just have to decide, does this violate the Constitution or doesn't it?
Tell me what this means. Judge Walker wrote that the Supreme Court has stated that government cannot enforce moral or religious beliefs without an accompanying secular purpose.
This is also settled law. Just take a step back. The basis for the judge's opinion was that the restriction of marriage to heterosexual couples didn't have a rational basis. So under the 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment says that no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. The Supreme Court has said that that means, at a minimum, that a law has to have a rational basis. And several bases are just excluded from that. So a mere bare desire to harm a politically unpopular group can't be enough to justify a law. So that's out. And another thing that is out is religious justification. You can't justify a law just because some people's religious beliefs support it. Otherwise, Brown versus Board of Education would have had to come out the other way because there were people in the South who sincerely believed, as a matter of religion, that God wanted to keep the races separate.
Mm-hmm.
Religious beliefs are so various. If you could invoke a religious justification for a law, it's hard to see which constitutional rights would survive.
Now, the judge stayed this decision until at least Friday. What's the story on that?
One question when you make a decision and the decision is going to be appealed is, what relief should you make available in the meantime? And so the judge understands that he might be reversed. And so the question is it the case that somebody is going to be irreversibly harmed, or is it the case that the status quo is going to be irreversibly changed in favor of one side while the litigation is ongoing? And judges are supposed to avoid, while the litigation is ongoing, bringing about something that brings about an irreversible change. So if he were to require California to start issuing marriage licenses, there wouldn't be any way to take back those marriage licenses some years down the road. There's also a more strategic consideration, which is that if he were to decide that the marriage licenses should issue immediately, he's not the only one who gets to decide whether his order should be stayed. If he denies the stay, if he says issue the licenses immediately, that's appealable right away to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the court directly above him. And if they deny the stay, then it's appealable up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court could issue the stay. And he, I think, doesn't really want this case going up to the U.S. Supreme Court in a hurry, where the court is going to have to make a decision really fast, and then the judges would, by making that decision, commit themselves to one side or the other side in advance of the argument being made to them.
I see.
So even if you're friendly to same-sex marriage, there are good reasons to support the judge's decision to stay this, because he wants that decision in his hands. He doesn't want it going up to the Supreme Court, where judges who you're hoping are ultimately going to vote in favor of same-sex marriage would probably hesitate to impose that result on California in advance of them hearing it. And so at that point, they would have to go on the record casting a vote against issuing marriage licenses. You don't want to put the Supreme Court in that position. It might prejudice the case later.
And let's talk about later. Is there little doubt that this is headed to the Supreme Court?
Well, I actually think there's substantial doubt as to whether this is headed for the Supreme Court. Everybody says it's going to.
Right.
But I don't think that the Supreme Court wants to take this case. I don't think the Supreme Court wants to take a position right now on same-sex marriage. Certainly, a few years ago, when it struck down a Texas law that made homosexual sex illegal, the court made quite clear in its opinion that it was taking no position at all on same-sex marriage. And I think they feel like this is politically radioactive and the states are working it through anyway, and I think they'd very much prefer not to get involved. So again, I said it before, there are three levels of federal court. There are the district courts, there are the courts of appeals, to which anybody can take an appeal. So this case is immediately going. The appeal has already been filed. It's going to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, a court of appeals which covers basically the West Coast. And there's no telling what the Ninth Circuit is going to do. The Ninth Circuit might uphold the district court's decision, or it might reverse it. I think that if the Ninth Circuit were to hold that there is no right to same-sex marriage, that at that point the U.S. Supreme Court would not feel under any particular pressure to take the case. And at that point, I think it would be very unlikely that the Supreme Court would take the case.
If, however, they do, if they...
Yes. Yeah. That's right. If the Ninth Circuit says that the district court was right, and that same-sex marriage is a constitutional requirement, then it would be very hard to imagine the U.S. Supreme Court staying away from the case. I think that then they would be likely to hear it. And if they heard it, I think the outcome is quite unpredictable.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting to me that the Supreme Court wouldn't look for a way to take up this case, because many would say that this is one of the major civil rights issues of our time and that something needs to be decided.
But the Supreme Court is reluctant to take on the whole country. It's very careful about its political position. Alexander Hamilton said in the Federalist Papers, defending the powers of the Supreme Court, that the court really hasn't got any power at all except its ability to persuade other people to do what it says. Unlike Congress, it doesn't have the spending power. Unlike the president, it doesn't have any weapons. All that it has is its own persuasive power. And so the court worries about that. And I could imagine, now Justice Ginsburg, for example, has said, she said before she got on the court, she thought that the court moved too quickly on abortion in Roe versus Wade. She said that she thought that the states were already working their way through this problem, that abortion rights activists were making progress, and that the Supreme Court, by coming down and imposing abortion on the whole country, demobilized the pro-choice movement. They all relaxed and went home, and mobilized the opponents of abortion, who became a powerful force in American politics. I think that Ginsburg certainly would worry about the same thing happening here. And so I could imagine Ginsburg saying, look, the good guys are winning here. I think I suspect that Ginsburg in her heart of hearts supports same-sex marriage. But I also think that she would say, look, you know, look at the amazing progress you've made in state legislatures. It's only been 10 years since Vermont recognized domestic partnerships. And at this point, a quarter of the population of the country lives in a state that has either same-sex marriage or its functional equivalent. Even in California, they've got domestic partnerships which have all of the same rights and benefits as marriage. What good would it do for the Supreme Court to take on more than 40 states on this issue when progress is actually being made at a state-by-state level?
Our guest,
I can imagine even Justice Ginsburg saying, you know, I want to leave this alone for a while.
Our guest this hour is Professor Andrew Koppelman. He is John Paul Stevens Professor of Law, Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University, author of Same-Sex, Different States, When Same-Sex Marriages Cross State Lines. We're talking about the decision last week, the federal judge in California, Vaughn Walker, opinion strongly in favor of same-sex marriage. The outcome, it's hard to be predicted here, although our guest says he doubts that this will go all the way to the Supreme Court unless the appeals court rules also in the same way here. He found, Judge Walker, that California's voter-approved ban, you remember Proposition 8, irrationally discriminates against gay men and lesbians. And we're talking this hour about same-sex marriage. And opponents, of course, of same-sex marriage believe that the ruling was a travesty. There was a referendum here, and they believe it usurped the will of millions of California voters. Here's our phone number. Join us. I imagine you will on this issue. 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, Dr. Connie Mariano will be joining us. She is the author of The White House Doctor, My Patients Were Presidents, a memoir. And her patients were President Bill Clinton, President the first Bush, and the second Bush. But most of the years were spent in the Clinton presidency. She has some amazing stories to tell. Let's go to phone calls now. Janice from La Crosse is our first caller. Hello, Janice.
Hi. Thank you, Kathleen. Good morning. And, Professor, thank you for taking my call. I'm basically just horrified and outraged by that decision. And I don't, you know, I just feel like marriage is not being defined. For me, this is just loosely being thrown around. And for me, marriage is between one man and one woman, or none of us would be here. So I just feel like, you know, I'm not prejudiced. God loves everybody, you know, but I will never call a same-sex homosexual, a civil union, that's fine, but I will never call that a marriage, never go to my deathbed, you know, because I feel like saying, no, that's sacred. It is a civil union, that's fine, but don't call that a marriage. Don't call that a marriage, you know. And the whole state said no, but then you get one judge, just like in Roe v. Wade, and all of a sudden they make that a law, and everybody's supposed to abide. And I'm with Ginsburg on that one. Absolutely, Roe v. Wade never should have been done, and this is just going to stir up a pot. But I feel like, you know, civil unions, yes, that's no problem. I mean, that's great. Don't call it a marriage. I will never call a homosexual, quote, marriage. That will never, ever happen for me.
Okay, thanks for your call, Professor Koppelman.
Well, one of the interesting things about this issue is that so many Americans share the attitude that Janice just articulated, I think, very well. But we see a lot of states, including California, are willing to give same-sex couples all of the same rights and benefits as marriage as long as you withhold the name. There is a clear majority in favor of that. In fact, there's a recent poll that suggests that more than half of white evangelical Christians under the age of 30 agree that same-sex couples should have all of the same rights and benefits. And in some ways, it's a bit puzzling why there's so much investment in the word marriage. It's also another reason why I think the Supreme Court is likely not to want to take this case, because all that's at stake is the label of marriage. California gives same-sex couples all of the same rights and benefits as marriage. I think that what's going on is that marriage really has two aspects. One aspect is administrative. It's just a set of rights and benefits that the state gives out to people. But it also, and this is very peculiar in a country that has no establishment of religion, that marriage has this quasi-religious aspect of the state giving its seal of approval to same-sex relationship, or to whatever relationships it gives the label of marriage. So then I suppose the challenge for somebody like Janice is to explain, so what exactly is it about heterosexual marriages that makes them have this superior characteristic that same-sex relationships just can't have? That's a debate that's happening not just in legislatures, it's happening in religious denominations. And I think every religious denomination in the country is divided about that question, sometimes, as in the case of the Anglicans, approaching schism.
And do you think that it is primarily people are worried about children of these unions? Is that the religious basis here? They're afraid of their moral upbringing? Or is it, what's the genesis of it?
I think that it's really an ultimate value judgment because, Janice can speak to this, but it sounds like, just from what she said, that her views wouldn't change if you were to tell her what, in fact, the psychologists are now pretty much unanimous on, that children raised by same-sex couples turn out just as well on any measure of well-being that's detectable as children raised by heterosexual couples. They thrive just as well. They do as well in school. They finish school at the same rates. No higher rate of teen pregnancy. They don't get into trouble with the police. They get the same grades. But I think that there's an ultimate value judgment here, so that people who are object to applying the word marriage to same-sex couples just think that there is something about heterosexual marriage that cannot be duplicated by same-sex couples. The challenge in litigation, like the litigation that's going on now, is for the state to come up with a way of articulating the basis for that ultimate value judgment.
Yes.
So far, the state has not done a very good
job. Well, it's a tricky thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. We go to Peter in Sauk City. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. And I just have a couple quick questions, and I haven't heard it really addressed anywhere, and other than to say, well, we're not going that far. There's religions in our country that believe in polygamy, be it the Mormons or some of the Muslim sects, believe in having more than one wife, and I've heard so many people say, well, these folks just want to be happy, the same sex couples, they want to be happy. What's wrong with letting them be happy? Well, if these religions, I mean, would this ruling carry over to that type of union? Because it's what makes us happy, and if it's a marriage in my eyes or in their eyes, they say, well, that's my marriage. This is how we live. What is there a reason that this ruling wouldn't cover that? I guess I don't know how it possibly could be, because just because it's between two people, well, why can't it be between four or five people?
Professor?
Well, everything turns on what the basis was for the decision and what the rule was that the court applied. And I think Peter is absolutely right that if the court had based its decision on a rule that people have a right to do anything that makes them happy, then that would reach polygamy, that would reach the use of presently illegal drugs, it would reach an awful lot of things. It would be basically anarchic in its implications. But that wasn't wasn't the basis of the court's decision. The basis of the court's decision was for the state to articulate a rational basis for drawing the line that it drew. So then when you raise the polygamy question, you'd have to ask, can you articulate a rational basis for discriminating between polygamous and monogamous marriages? I think that you can come up with reasons for distinguishing between polygamous and monogamous marriages. Polygamous marriages, we've got, I think, substantial evidence that they tend to be patriarchal. They tend to involve the subordination of women. They tend to involve the mistreatment, particularly of male children. They tend to produce a social hierarchy in which some, among males in particular, where some men have lots of wives and some men have none, and subordination of women to men as well. And I think that if someone were to bring a challenge against the prohibition of polygamy, that you'd be able to introduce plenty of evidence on that basis. Remember, I said, all of our evidence is that we can't detect any difference between children raised by same-sex and opposite-sex couples, and we can't detect any difference in the quality of the relationships. None of those things are true of polygamous families.
Mm-hmm. So if the Court of Appeals, Professor Koppelman, were to reverse this decision from Judge Walker, considering the fact that it was so exhaustive, there were so many witnesses, it was a 136-page opinion, they would have to do so on the basis of what?
Well, they would have to find a rational basis for the state drawing the line that it did. I'm not sure how you could write that decision in an intellectually honest way. On the other hand, if I were a Ninth Circuit judge and I was inclined to reverse, and again, I might be inclined to reverse for just the reasons that I hypothetically attributed to Justice Ginsburg before,
right,
where I'd say, look, this is not the time for this to go up, even though I'm sympathetic to same-sex marriage. I don't want this going to the Supreme Court, so I want to reverse this and shut this litigation down. If I can't do that in an intellectually honest way, there's always the option of doing it in an intellectually dishonest way, by writing a decision that just rushes ahead to bald conclusions on the basis of bad reasoning. And if I'm a judge, well, so I do some damage to my reputation by doing that, because people look at my opinion and say that it's a silly opinion. But, if I'm a responsible person and I want to advance the country, I shouldn't just worry about my own opinion. I should try to think about what's good for the country. I can feel pretty confident that if I reverse the trial court, if I say there's no right to same-sex marriage, no matter how bad the opinion is that I write, the Supreme Court isn't going to reverse me. They're going to read my opinion with relief and decline to hear the case, and that'll be the end.
Let's go next to Peter. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Jacob in Menominee. Hi, Jacob.
Hi. I have I've got a question. Why is everybody uptight about same-sex marriage? Because 2,000 years ago, the Greeks, as you know, probably know, they were always together, and they were homosexual and stuff, and I got a couple friends that are homosexual, and why don't a lot of people accept them?
Professor Koppelman.
Well, this is a deep psychological question.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the previous two callers clearly were concerned about same-sex marriage. Just to get clear on the history, the ancient Greeks never had same-sex marriage. They practiced homosexual sex, and it had a very different meaning in ancient Greece than it does today. The question of why are people so opposed to same-sex marriage, I think that it is an ultimate value judgment. I think its basis has been changing, though. The fact that you've got opponents of same-sex marriage, like your first caller, Janice, who quite strongly opposed to same-sex marriage, but is willing not only to tolerate the existence of same-sex couples in American society, but is even willing to give them all of the same rights and benefits as marriage, suggests to me that the attitudes that we've got have changed. If you look at what the law was 50 years ago, all over the country, police departments had officers whose specific assigned jobs was to go to places where gay people met and try to hunt down the gay people and arrest them. So they were diverting law enforcement resources from robberies and burglaries to try to hunt down gay people. So we've seen a huge shift. The antipathy that people felt toward gay people 50 years ago has really become disreputable even among conservatives today, even among people who are opposed to same-sex marriage and to gay rights. So I think that historians are going to say in the future that we're living through a transitional period right now. And so the attitudes really are, I think it's unstable. I mean, it's hard to say that same-sex couples are entitled to a legitimate place in society, but it's got to be a second-class status. I don't think that that's stable in the long run. I think that's where we are now.
You are, in addition to being a professor of law, a professor of political science, there's been a lot written about the political ramifications of this decision. Some Republicans saying just stay on the economy, skip this as a area of discussion because of what you just said, that more conservatives are in favor of perhaps gay marriage, but certainly domestic unions, civil unions. So is this going to be in certain races politically advantageous to talk about the outrageousness of the judge's decision? And on the other hand, will some who believe in the decision use it politically to say this was a courageous decision and it's a sign of things that need to come?
I would expect that in the short run, this is likely to be good for Republicans, because what a basic problem for any political party, particularly in an off-year election like the one that's coming up where there isn't a presidential race going on, is getting people to turn out and vote at all. People tend to be interested in politics when there is a presidential election, not so much when there isn't. And what this is likely to do immediately is to get evangelical Christian voters, particularly ones over 35, because those are the ones who feel the strongest antipathy to same-sex marriage, to turn out and vote, and maybe even to work for political campaigns. And you got to be able to do that in a political campaign to get those people who are willing to go out and work for you. It's why Sarah Palin was so helpful to John McCain in the last presidential campaign, despite all of her obvious deficits. So in the short run, I think probably marginally good for Republicans. How good for Republicans? We're going to have to see.
Right. Thanks, Jacob. Bill in Madison. Hi.
Hello. Janice sort of pushed one of my buttons earlier in the call sequence. She says, I'm not prejudiced. To me, that's just code for she's prejudiced. And keep in mind that if you look at the picketers in any of these demonstrations, they quote Old Testament Bible verses, which basically say homosexuals should be stoned, not given political rights. But given that, I think the main thing is that people like Janice and people like, I think, the majority of America now who have grown up since they quit teaching civics in high school, they think democracy means majority rule. And it just flat doesn't. Otherwise, you have a dictatorship of the majority. That's why we have a constitution, is to protect minority rights. And the fact that the overwhelming majority may agree with her is absolutely irrelevant. And I just wish people could get that straight. And I think it's a shameful demonstration of how little our citizens today know how about how our government works and how our founding fathers intended democracy on American soil to work.
On the other hand, Bill, there are very few politicians who have taken on this issue. The president is not in favor of same-sex marriage. You'd be hard-pressed to find too many who were championing this cause.
Well, I don't believe what any politician says he's in favor of. He's in favor of whatever the wind is telling him to be in favor of this day, whatever political party they're from. It's a radioactive issue. I just get angry whenever I hear people talk about the will of the people being should be the arbiter of an issue like this. The will of the people is, you know, is often, in fact, most of the time, I think, just wrong.
Professor Koppelman.
Well, I think the more charitable way to read people who make this argument is the following. That it is true, we've got a constitution, and that means that the will of the people is not dispositive. On the other hand, we have a constitutional democracy, which means that except with respect to a very few things that are controlled by the Constitution, we do make decisions democratically. And so the claim that the will of the people has been violated, I think read most charitably, has to involve the premise that, in fact, the district court was wrong and the Constitution does not bar the state of California from prohibiting same-sex marriage. So, and if you accept that premise, then it makes perfect sense because, you know, one objection to lots of constitutional decisions, a standard worry about the role of courts in American democracy, is that they're not elected. And so if the court misinterprets the Constitution and constrains the people in a way that the Constitution doesn't require, then we've got an oligarchy. But everything depends on the argument, and invoking the will of the people obviously is not that argument, the argument that, in fact, the district court got it wrong. So to have this discussion, we really have to talk about the merits. If the district court got it wrong, then it's wrongly overriding the will of the people. If the district court got it right, the district court got it right.
Professor Andrew Koppelman, John Paul Stevens, Professor of Law, Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University, is our guest as we look at the federal judge last week issuing an opinion in favor, a lengthy opinion, after hearing many witnesses in favor of same-sex marriage. More phone calls in a moment, 800-486-8655, the email talk at WPR.org on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Connie Mariano, author of The White House Doctor, My Patients Were Presidents, a memoir. And a fascinating one it is. She'll be with us following the news. We go back to phone calls. Brian in Appleton, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. You know, I appreciate Janice's sentiment, and I'm glad she sort of came out at the very beginning of the program, because that does echo a lot of this against the concept of marriage, gay marriage. But, you know, I still haven't heard anything significant from folks who echo that sentiment as to how it directly harms them, except for the fact that they just simply don't like it. Yet, you know, they roll out television programs that will tout things like The Bachelor, The Bachelorette, that almost makes a mockery of marriage on their own, and I'll bet she's probably one of the ones who watches the show on a religious basis. If people wanted to really prevent that type of thing, then I would suspect that they could make divorce illegal and adultery a felony. But my reason for calling was to say every time this happens, it seems like the Republicans in the last two elections have rolled out the process of trying to rally the troops with this in mind, and I don't know why. I just try to think, what is the true reason of trying to establish this from the perspective of that? What is their true benefit? And the only thing I can come up with is it the money? I mean, with all the states that do this on an individual basis, what you're going to have is a whole statewide cacophony that varies from state to state, but it still doesn't give you the federal benefits. So my question is it the money? I mean, I can't imagine why else it is. And then let's call it a religious process. For example, if someone who is owning a house with their partner and that partner should pass, and all of a sudden there's a huge windfall of tax that on inheritance would suddenly be lost to the government if marriage was in fact allowed to go forth on a federal issue.
All right, but Brian, we don't know what television stations Janice watches. That's not fair to Janice, you know?
Well, I realize I'm stereotyping.
All right,
again,
thank you for
there
not.
There are so many people that do watch that, and it's
understand.
Sort of a mockery of their argument.
Yeah, I understand that, but don't put Janice in that category. We don't know. Professor Koppelman, what do you think of that?
Well, you know, this is one of the things that's interesting about the same-sex marriage debate is the level of mutual incomprehension on both sides. That, you know, it's very hard for each side to understand what the other side is, someone like Janice can't understand how anyone could think that a same-sex marriage is the functional equivalent of a heterosexual marriage, how it could be as good. And then someone like Brian can't understand how Janice could possibly think what she thinks. So he wants to know, how can this harm Janice? I think maybe the best way to understand the view that Janice was offering is an ultimate value judgment. In Janice's case, it's clearly not about the money, because Janice said that she's willing to give same-sex couples all of the same legal rights and benefits, and that includes pension benefits, and that includes Social Security benefits, and that includes tax exemption when one of the partners dies and the other one inherits the house. So it's clearly not about the money. Maybe the best way to think about this think about other ultimate value judgments. So one law that's clearly animated by an ultimate value judgment is the Endangered Species Act. People think that it's important that certain species that they're never going to encounter be kept alive on the planet, that it's important. For instance, we know that polar bears are endangered by global warming. Well, there are people who are upset about that who are never planning on traveling to the place where polar bears have their habitat, just because they think that the polar bear is an intrinsically beautiful, wonderful animal, and it would be awful if polar bears disappeared from the planet. I think that what's driving opponents of same-sex marriage is the idea that this ideal of marriage as exclusively heterosexual is something that is of ultimate value like that. But it's been very hard for them to articulate why. There's a difference between this and the polar bear is that we see that people who admire endangered species have done a pretty good job of passing on that view to the next generation. So, you talk to teenagers, and teenagers are quite upset about the endangerment of the polar bear. They
right.
think that the polar bear is a beautiful thing. When you ask them about the endangerment of marriage as exclusively heterosexual, they're puzzled. They don't see what the fuss is.
Right.
So I think that it's the ultimate value judgment that's doing the work, but it's an ultimate value judgment that is itself an endangered species. It's disappearing.
Do you think that maybe people are also upset about their ideal, the reality not living up to their ideal of marriage? That another conversation underneath all of this is everybody's really upset that marriage doesn't seem to be working. There's a high rate of divorce. The out-of-wedlock birth situation is unbelievable in this country right now. So they're defending something that just isn't what it used to be, if it ever was.
Yeah, although there, now we're not talking about ultimate value judgments. Now we're talking about functional judgments about what kinds of arrangements and what kinds of behaviors are actually likely to contribute to the flourishing of human beings in a tangible way.
Mm-hmm.
And there, we see that the country has actually become quite stratified with respect to the stability of marriages. And actually, the populations within the country that are most supportive of same-sex marriage are the ones that have the lowest divorce rates. So one thing that correlates very heavily with support for same-sex marriage is higher levels of education and income. And in the top quartile of income, women have basically the same divorce rates that women did in the 1950s in the United States.
Really? I didn't know that.
No increase at all in the divorce rate
huh.
among those people. So the idea that same-sex marriage is in some way connected with a high rate of divorce just isn't true of the actual populations we see. In some ways, the same-sex marriage movement is a conservative movement within the gay rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
The claim is not, we're different, we want absolute unbridled sexuality and the ability to follow happiness wherever we find it. In fact, these people want stable, enduring relationships. And the gay rights movement itself is quite divided about that. This is a conservative strand within the gay rights movement.
Yeah. We should do a show on divorce, because that's new information for me. That would be interesting to look at what the rates are, while we're thinking about it. Rich and Sullivan. Hey, Rich.
Hey, thank you. I think your guest is very articulate and on most points precise, but my point is an expansion of an earlier caller's point, and that is that if the decision ultimately has to come down to a tallying of harms, H-A-R-M-S, to people, that civil unions do not operate at the federal level, it's conceivable that our nation may repeal a military service policy called the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And it's conceivable that lesbians and gays may serve an entire career, decades, in the armed forces, in addition to the question of the Social Security benefits and so on and so forth. Your guest just said that some same-sex households have much greater base income to be concerned about passing on to their loved one, their spouse. I simply do not see how a court can argue logically that if someone has been in the Navy, Army, Air Force, Marines, or whatever for 35 years and they die and they have a pension and they cannot, a military pension, and they cannot pass that on to their partner, even in that narrow sense, the economic harm to the surviving person is immense. It is absolutely something that no heterosexual couple would minimize if it were going, the decision were going that way in their union.
Professor Koppelman.
Well, and this goes back to the question of administrative benefits versus the word marriage. And again, you'll recall the very first caller, Janice, said that she had no problem with the tangible benefits going to same-sex couples. Yet Don't Ask, Don't Tell is going to be repealed. And one thing that we are going to see, I think, very soon after Don't Ask, Don't Tell is repealed, is we are going to see some gay person who is in the military get killed in Afghanistan. And under present federal law, that person's surviving spouse will get no benefits. In fact, if you read the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which says no recognition of same-sex marriages literally, not only can't you give them benefits, you can't even give them the normal, respectful treatment that you give to any other military widow or widower, of having the military go personally and notify them that their spouse has been killed. Mm. I don't think that the country is going to stand for that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that present federal law that denies any kind of federal recognition to marriages that are valid under state law is not going to be able to endure. That's got to change.
Thanks, Rich, for the call. A couple minutes left. Here's a Facebook posting from Melody. My partner and I have been together for almost 30 years. Initially, I didn't care what it was called. What I want are federal benefits so we can take care of each other if something happens. But listening to people's views, including some friends and family, unless it's called marriage, they don't consider our relationship on par to theirs. That's why we must have the right to marriage. Do you want to respond to that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So this other aspect, so I said that the administrative benefits matter. It also matters whether you give it the name of marriage, and it matters in two different ways. One is that there is this honorific of marriage, and people know what it is, and people understand that these two things bleed into one another. If you call it civil unions, generally, even for purposes of things like giving people insurance benefits, the ordinary administrator of human resources in a company doesn't know what that is, and so doesn't know what the appropriate thing is to do. But there's also a real concern about second-class status, and it shouldn't be minimized. So the type of marriage that previously was most controversial in American history was interracial marriages, marriages between blacks and whites, which were outlawed in more than 40 states at various times in American history and only became legal throughout the United States when the Supreme Court struck down all the prohibitions in 1967. I don't think anyone today thinks that it would have been okay for the southern states to respond to that decision by saying, well, all right, interracial couples are going to get civil unions, or we'll call them domestic partnerships. We're just not going to call them marriages. That wouldn't have been acceptable in that context, and it's quite clear why.
Professor Koppelman, you've been a very, very good guest. Thank you so much for being with us, and we hope to have you on again talking about politics. Good, thanks. Professor Andrew Koppelman, John Paul Stevens Professor of Law, Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University. His book is, well, he has several, but the most recent, Same Sex, Different States, When Same-Sex Marriages Cross State Lines. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production as well. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We're also on Facebook if you want to carry on this conversation. I forget to tell you that. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. And if you didn't get your comment on the air, and I'm sorry, we just didn't have time for all of them, put it on Facebook. And we're at the point now where people are responding to each other, which is great. News coming up. We'll be back for another hour. It should be a good one.